The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This show, for all of you who don't know or haven't listened to this show often, this show is about the Orthodox faith, but it's about a rendering of the Orthodox faith that's relevant to us living in this corrupt world. But even more than that, it deals with the reception and the life and the tradition and the mentality of the Orthodox worldview, not only in Eastern Europe, where, of course, it's dominant, but also in Western Europe. I'm a man of Western background, of Irish background, and I think most of my listeners are of Western background as well. You know, one of the many things on this show that we stress is the idea that Western Europe, prior to the early 12th century, was part of the universal Orthodox Church, what would be called the true Orthodox Catholic Church. And then, of course, the demands of the universal jurisdiction of the papacy, among many other things, caused the two parts of Christendom to split, leaving the Church, which by its very nature is indivisible, to be the patrimony of the East. St. John Maximovich used to say that one of the benefits of the Bolshevik Revolution was that it forced Russians from their earlier isolation and forced them to travel the globe as exiles, and in the process converting many people to the Orthodox point of view. And today is September 2nd, 2011. And what's significant about today is that it's the 29th anniversary of the death of Father Seraphim Rose. Father Seraphim, I would ask that you look him up if you haven't heard of him or haven't read anything by him, is an American convert to the Russian Orthodox Church and has a lot in common with us as people who are, or at least as a, you know, as American population who are always searching for the truth, never quite finding it. And Father Seraphim was an example to me in more ways than one, and was a direct student of St. John Maximovich when he was Archbishop in San Francisco. But that brings us to the topic of today, which is the development of the early Roman Empire. And when I say that, I mean the early Roman Empire in Byzantium, in Greece, the early Eastern Roman Empire is what I really mean to say, sometimes called the Byzantine Empire, the Empire of Constantinople. They called themselves simply Israel, that Byzantium was the New Jerusalem, the Empire was the New Israel. And one of the more worthwhile books in this field is probably very much worth your time, Mark Whitlow's The Making of Byzantium, 600-1025. And this is, these represent the earlier years of the Roman Empire in the East. Even though the Byzantines referred to themselves as Israel and Constantinople as the New Jerusalem, in a political manner, they refer to themselves as Romans and exclusively as Romans. And one of the ways that the Western papacy eventually came to insult the Byzantine Empire was to simply refer to them as Greeks. Not that there's anything wrong with being Greeks, but that it took the universal concept of the Orthodox Empire and rendered them merely an ethnic group. And the struggle for the word Rome is something that's extremely important in European history, because the Byzantines, of course, were even the canons and the old constitution of the late Roman Empire in the West understood the Eastern emperors as Roman, of course. After the fall of the empire, the Russians in Moscow took the term the New Rome or the Third Rome, because two czars had married into the Byzantine royal family, so there was no question as to their legitimacy. But even in the West, under Charlemagne, and then his much later German successors who I've dealt with on the show, the Ottonian era, which was a great era in Northern Europe, also took the name of Rome. And as I've written before, and there's an essay on this, on the Voice of Reason site, called The Third Rome and the Western Rite. And since I do the Western Rite, I've been trained in the Western Rite by Metropolitan John in New Jersey, the man who ordained me. The concept of Rome is the concept of this universal legal order informed by the Orthodox faith. But if Moscow is to be the Third Rome, then this universal jurisdiction, so to speak, is reflected in the fact that it has to take into itself all the rites, traditions, and customs of all Christendom, at least while Christendom was unified and Orthodox in its Eastern and Western halves. The old believers had accused Peter the Great in leaving Moscow and creating an empire rather than a strong Orthodox church-based society, of abandoning the very concept of the Third Rome and turning Russia from the city on the hill to just another empire. Anyway, the concept of the Second Rome is significant because even the canons in the ancient church referred to the Eastern Roman Empire as the Second Rome. And when the First Rome collapsed militarily, what we would call the early Middle Ages, and then went into heresy and schism, starting roughly the end of the 11th century, that the Byzantines then were left, at least from the point of view of the faith, as the only society that had any right to call itself Rome. And then when Byzantium fell to the Turks in 1453, and really prior to that was really an insignificant power, that Roman application went to the Russians. Now, early Byzantium, the early Roman Empire in the East, is about how the Eastern emperors consolidated their authority in what we would call Northern Turkey today, in the face of the collapse of Western Roman civilization. On the one hand, constant attacks from groups like the Persians and the nomadic tribal societies of Asia. What we need to understand is that the Byzantine Empire was an Orthodox and Christian empire, highly militarized, that survived and protected all of Europe, not merely itself, but protected all of Europe from the constant and incessant attacks from the east and the southeast. The Byzantines were bled white over a long period of time because they were dedicated to protecting what they called, and what I call, Israel, or the Orthodox Church, as it's manifested in that part of the world. We have to understand that the Byzantine Empire was a Roman Orthodox Christian empire that survived from its establishment by St. Constantine the Great in the 4th century all the way to its final fall in 1453. And I've heard the argument, it's actually a very stupid argument. Every once in a while, one of these anti-Christian types will say that Christianity makes people weak, it makes people not want to defend themselves, they only care about the other world, not this world, and they seem to be blissfully, almost euphorically ignorant about the Byzantines, never mind the Russians, who maintained the Christian Eastern Roman Empire for 1,000 years, and 1,000 years of nearly constant warfare for the sake of protecting itself and all of Europe from the attacks, starting with the Persians and the tribal societies of the East, to the Islamic attack. And the only reason that, you know, people, great men like Charles Martel, were able to function was because the Byzantines had done tremendous damage to their military capacity long before they were able to reach the western part of North Africa. So we need to give the Byzantines their due, and this, you know, development of the so-called Romano-Byzantine Russian idea, which is absolutely so central to European history, to the history of the church, and of course was really the military arm of the Orthodox Church, for lack of a better phrase. These are the people who bled and bled and bled century after century after century in constant warfare against those groups and tribes that wanted to invade Europe and impose their own point of view, especially the Islamic point of view, throughout the continent. So let's put an end to these very stupid arguments that somehow Christianity renders its supporters ignorant and weak and incapable of thinking in a military way, because there was no greater military machine at its time by far than the Byzantine Empire. And we need to understand that the peace that Christ gives to his church exists only in the church. And those moral rules and the way that we think exist and have application only in the church. Those outside of the church, we do our best to convert them, but if they are hostile to our people, if they are hostile to our church, we are called upon to defend it by any means necessary. They are not our personal enemies. We turn the other cheek with other Orthodox people because they are our personal enemies. The very, very different thing when we are defending our people from attack. Christ's injunction to turn the other cheek refers only to those in the church, refers only to our people who are personal enemies, our personal opponents. It does not refer to those outside of the church who, of course, in the Old Testament were dealt with in a very, very harsh manner when they were hostile towards God's people. Christ, in his ministry, of course, assumed that people were aware of the Old Testament and were assumed that people knew it very, very well, and of course did absolutely nothing to reverse this concept that the church will defend itself from those who seek to destroy it. If we do not defend the church by any means necessary from those who attempt to destroy it, then we are guilty of murder because we have permitted our people to be killed and we didn't do anything about it. So those injunctions of Christ, while they, of course, are very profound and very true, they refer, number one, only to people within the church, and number two, only to our personal enemies, not enemies of the church in general. Okay, so let's talk about Byzantium. I want to really go from roughly 600 to the reign of my favorite Byzantine monarch, and really one of my favorite political people of all time, Basil II. The Eastern Roman Empire, we need to remember, was by far the wealthiest part of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had the overwhelming majority of its urban power in the East, not in the West. Eastern Roman peasants, generally speaking, were small landholders. They were the basic unit of production. In general, the Byzantine Empire set itself against the development of any kind of landlordism, and only when the central institutions of the empire grew weak did you have the development of great landlords and then serfs to work the land. Generally speaking, there is no such thing as serfdom in Byzantium. It never really knew serfdom. What it knew, in very general terms, was a very prosperous society of peasants who owned their own land in general. Now, depending on the military fortunes of the empire, as money began to flow out of the empire into the field armies, to the point where the empire was pretty regularly broke because it was constantly financing the armed services, large estates developed domestically, and yet it still it never descended to serfdom, but it was largely a collection of rent-paying peasants. So even at the worst of Byzantine landlordism, which didn't occur for all that long and only occurred in periods of weakness, you generally had just rent payers, tenant farmers, rather than serfs in the normal kind of technical sense of the term. Byzantine wealth was based largely on a network of cities. Alexandria, Thessalonica, Antioch, these were major Roman cities, speaking both Latin and Greek, at least at its upper levels, and were the source of the income for the empire in general. They were controlled by an oligarchy, but this oligarchy was not a paid ruling class. They ruled from their own money, which is an old Roman custom. All public works, including military preparedness, fortresses, the walls, aqueducts, everything else, they paid for out of their own pocket. So it's a very different kind of oligarchic rule than you have in the modern world. And on the other hand, hospitals and orphanages, poor relief, education, libraries, that was taken care of largely by the monasteries and the monastic orders. A monastery in the Byzantine Empire was more than just a spiritual center. It was a cultural, artistic center. It was an economic center. It was an educational center. You cannot overestimate the importance of monasteries in both East and West in rebuilding Western civilization. These are the ones who maintained all of the ancient documents. These are the ones who maintained both Greek and Latin classics. These were the people who copied the books, who did the translations, who made the classics available to those who could read and write of the time. And so not only that, these were the hospitals, and they were places for all forms of poor relief, especially in times of plague. The city, however, while they had this oligarchy that ruled and ruled really out of its own pocket, the bishop, what we would call the metropolitan of a major city, was the most important factor. And usually the bishop was powerful enough to control any excess of the oligarchy. The Byzantine Empire, of course, was a monetary economy, was not a subsistence economy. And East Rome continued to prosper. And by 600, the Eastern Roman Empire was by far the wealthiest society in the world. Her currency was the strongest, completely controlled by the emperor personally. And that currency, as I've written many, many times before, had value and was used as far away as China, because the Byzantine currency had an international reputation for solidity. But from 650 to 750, a lot changed. And the thing that changed was the development of Islam. Islam developed when the Byzantines and the Persians had exhausted each other in this period of time. They both retreated to their respective strongholds, and that Arabian Peninsula suddenly had a cultural vacuum. And that cultural vacuum was filled by Muhammad. Muhammad used the money he made from his caravan trading and essentially shaking down the caravan trade through that part of the world, and used that money to spread the new doctrine, which took a lot of influence from the Orthodox people in the region, a lot of influence from the Jews of the region. So, like C.S. Lewis and a lot of other writers, I tend to agree that Islam really is an amalgam of Jewish and certain elements of Orthodox theology, maybe an extreme Nestorian theology, maybe for lack of a better phrase. It's a reinterpretation of Nestorianism with Jewish influences, and their organization was not as a state, was not as a church, but merely a military body. And there are some who go so far as really to say that Islam isn't so much a religion, but rather a military doctrine. But the rise of Islam, it's amazing and fairly sudden wealth and power coming both from the Jews as well as from the caravan traders in the region. It spread rapidly and exclusively by the sword. But what this meant for the Byzantine economy was that the Byzantines were now cut off from many of their wealth-producing regions in Syria and later on in Egypt. While Constantinople itself prospered, the empire was slowly becoming poorer. And even as Whitlow, who certainly is not anti-Islamic, he's forced to come to the conclusion that the conquests of Islam and their taking of the sources of wealth that formerly had gone to the Byzantine Empire, that's the main reason for its success. That's the main reason for its spreading. It's true that all of its movement was military, but it was only military because they had the money to finance it. This is why Islam developed the way it did. It had exclusive Jewish support in the area because the Jews, more than anything else, wanted to get rid of the Orthodox Greek influence from the region. And so almost from its inception, there was a Judeo-Islamic movement against the Byzantine Empire, and to be honest with you, in 2011, that movement continues to exist and continues to make war on Russia and Orthodoxy in general. Okay, we'll finish this up when I come back. I'm going to talk about development of the Byzantine way of life and the way of thought from roughly 750 to the reign of Basil II.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about ancient Byzantium, the early years of the Eastern Roman Empire, And the Byzantine basic conception of itself and what it was in the world is the continuation of Israel. It is, in fact, the new Israel, Constantinople, the new Jerusalem. But the big question scholars used to have is, how was it that the Byzantine Empire survived 1,000 years under some of the harshest conditions, militarily and economically, that you can imagine? And the answer, which is really very hard to argue with, is the fact that Constantine and his successors, Justinian in particular, but many others, realized that the centralization and bureaucratization of all government administration, the church, and the army were absolutely necessary for survival. What bureaucracy did, a literate, well-trained civil service based on merit, not on family connections, existed to continue the basic policies of the empire, its military strategy, paying the army, collecting taxes, all of this stuff, even if the emperor died and there was no one was chosen, even if the emperor was incompetent, if the emperor simply didn't care, if the emperor was corrupt, if the emperor was killed, the system didn't necessarily rely on the person of the emperor. Oftentimes, the emperor was away on campaign. That was normal, and it was expected of any emperor at the time. This is the reason why women were not heavily involved in politics. Women weren't involved in politics not because there was some male conspiracy to eliminate them, but because they weren't military figures. The emperor was a sacral figure, but he was a sacral figure because the law was enforced via military conquest and defense. And therefore, the emperor was expected to go on campaign with the army. I also want to say that the Byzantine Navy doesn't get a lot of attention. The Byzantine Navy was the most advanced of its day, the strongest of its day. A lot of the opponents of the Byzantine Empire, Islam included, did not spend a lot of time developing its navy. The navy, for it to be competent, requires a lot more money than an army. And it requires a lot more money because you need a highly competent scientific class to be able to design ships and sails and rudders and fleets and strategy, where the army, you know, at least back then, you can get away with brute force. You could not get away with brute force in the navy. And, of course, most of you have heard of Greek fire before. I think there's some speculation as to what it was, but Greek fire was essentially a flamethrower that was attached to the warships of the Byzantine Navy, and it spat a long train of fire at its opponents. And the Byzantine Navy, because of the Greek fire was a state secret, the Byzantine Navy usually wiped out its opponents. But to have a navy that can control the seas, control the Aegean, the Mediterranean, this goes a long way in controlling the trade of the area. And so the Byzantine Navy really deserves a lot of credit for the maintenance of the empire over a long period of time. The Byzantine state revolved around the army and navy. The Byzantine, like the Western Roman infantry, was the best in the world. They weren't as big as their opponent, especially the Vikings, who when they first hit the southern Europe, these little Mediterranean men against these Vikings was kind of comical. And you need to remember that the Byzantines, the Romans, were almost always outnumbered by their opponents. And therefore, what they needed to do was compensate. And they compensated with a tremendous system of martial arts that made the lowest Roman soldier absolutely fearsome to his opponents. The true concept of martial arts, whether Roman or Greek, really was about the rejection of brute force and the use of mental subtlety and how to wield a weapon and how to deal with an opponent that overwhelmingly was far superior in numbers. The basic strategic mentality of the Byzantine Empire was, first of all, the development of elite forces, to always have units on campaign that were absolute masters of the sword or the bow or of horsemanship. Since the army was almost always outnumbered on campaign, it had to compensate with quality over quantity. The Byzantine army also, number two, avoided pitched battles whenever possible, because they were usually outnumbered, because they were usually fighting on foreign territory. They preferred surprise, they preferred a tremendous emphasis on strategy and psychological techniques to defeat their opponents. Number three, they were specialists in this very same realm. They were specialists in harassment, harassing their opponent, highly mobile, quick attacks. They destroyed any of their supplies that they couldn't carry with them. They destroyed anything that might be able to be used by their enemies. And finally, let me say that the Byzantine military apparatus stressed the virtue of patience. Byzantine martial arts can be summarized in terms of overall strategy by simply saying you never hit an opponent when they're at their best. You make life difficult for them long enough so that when they finally become exhausted, then you hit them full strength. Because the Byzantine forces were always outnumbered, they needed to use these kind of psychological methods. But there's an argument that I've been making for a long time, and I'm not the only one who makes this. The big thing, in my opinion, that permitted the Byzantine Empire to last for 1,000 years in one of the most tough neighborhoods in the world is the existence of a social institution called the Time. The Time was an imperial method of maintaining an army in peacetime by granting every soldier and his family land. The Time, which is spelled like the word theme, was a community of military families with each soldier and his family owning his own land and horse and all the implements necessary to live a civilized life in peacetime. This meant that every soldier had a stake in the empire. It meant that every family had a stake in the empire. It meant that soldiers in general were self-supporting and did not require regular infusions of money from the empire to support themselves, to arm themselves. These were peasant landholder soldiers. They were professional soldiers. They were part-time farmers. They were landowners. They were stakeholders in the empire. They were self-supporting. This, in my opinion, first of all, shows a tremendous justice that the Byzantine Empire was dedicated to. True citizenship means that you own land and that you're basically independent and self-supporting. It shows the fact that even the lowliest soldier was a landowner and had a stake in the empire. And that soldiers, while being professional, also had skills in terms of farming, agriculture, raising animals, basic survival. So these kind of men on campaign rarely really ever needed to worry about sustenance. And I think that the Time system, it says that a land ownership is something essential to being really human, to being a good citizen and a good man. And that kind of loyalty that was engendered from the fact that soldiers were given land and everything that they needed and were protected as real stakeholders in the society, it created a prosperous middle-class soldier peasantry, and the state was the main entity in protecting these men from the incursions of the oligarchy. Now, prior to the advent of the rule of Basil II, who, you know, changed everything in terms of global politics, really the dark times of the Byzantine Empire largely are from, let's say, 850 to maybe the year 1000. That period of time saw tremendous victories by Islam. It saw continued invasions of Byzantine territory by the Vikings and the Slavs. And this is largely prior to the Slavs being converted. The empire was shrinking. The empire was surrounded. Slowly, the Timur system began to collapse because the oligarchy, which was largely military families from the eastern part of the Byzantine Empire, controlled the state. And they controlled the state for their own purposes. Slowly, because of this, landholding was concentrated in a handful of major military families. The state then sought to protect the poor against the wealthy, and specifically in the area of taxes. As the empire began to shrink from the attacks coming from all sides, taxes went up. Once the Timur system began to collapse in this period of time, and it was resurrected later on, but once the Timur system began to collapse, taxes had to go up. The Timur system meant that these soldiers were largely self-supporting. They were very loyal. They were true supporters of the empire because of this. Taxes didn't have to be very high if they were largely self-supporting, but when the Timur system began to collapse, that all changed. And only in this period of time did you see a kind of a class warfare politics in Constantinople. But by the beginning of the reign of Basil, 976, roughly 976, that period of time, just before the year 1000, is where Basil II took the Byzantine Empire out of its dark age and brought it back to its older prosperity. Basil II is one of the strongest monarchs in all history. Basil II is one of the most important military leaders and theorists and strategists of all time. He takes power in the latter middle part of the 10th century, and he realizes that because of the class politics, because of the corruption of the bureaucracy, the domination of the oligarchic military families from Syria and Anatolia, he needed to use force to reform the bureaucracy, to reform the army. These eastern families, these eastern military families, were a threat to central control. Basil II takes the throne, and he takes it with the explicit view that he is going to destroy these families. And so, needless to say, civil war is not too far away. And these families, the oligarchs of Syria and elsewhere, begin electing emperors from among themselves and setting them up against Basil II. The only reason that Basil was able to defeat these military families was because, typical of the oligarchs, they were divided amongst themselves. And Basil did something else. He did something else of global, cosmic, historical significance. He went to Vladimir of Kiev and said, please help me. And if you help me against these traitors in our midst, I will open up the Byzantine Empire to trade with you and the Rus people. Part of the conditions, of course, was that Vladimir and his entourage had to be baptized. And then Basil would give a member of the royal family to Vladimir as his wife, and therefore he will be therefore a part of the Byzantine and hence the Roman Empire. And that's exactly what happened in 988. In terms of global politics, there is probably little more significant that occurred in this time than that, and therefore the and Vladimir and the Vikings that were with him were sent to Byzantium and were used to defeat the Eastern oligarchic military families. Not to mention the fact that Basil also, in his first attack against the pagans of what we would call today Bulgaria, had failed. Military defeat was a sure way of losing a throne at that time, and calling on Vladimir to assist him not only in domestic politics, but also in the Balkans was absolutely essential to Greek policy. It was Basil II, to a great extent, that created this Russo-Byzantine tradition that we talk about and we're still writing about today. The other thing that was significant, politically speaking, in the alliance with Vladimir of Kiev, we call, of course, St. Vladimir today, is that because Vladimir used his own men, both Slavs, Vikings, and those that were part Slav and part Viking, using those men to assist him in conquering Bulgaria, and therefore really having a firm grip on the Balkans and Balkan trade, which was necessary for him to kind of revitalize the administration, financially speaking, it also meant that Basil II did not owe anyone for his throne or for support. There was no family, there was no oligarchy, there was no movement that he owed anything to. He could rule as a true autocrat because he didn't owe anybody anything. That's always been the argument for monarchy, is that in so-called democracies, you can't do anything politically without money. You can't do anything unless you go to corporate America, unless you go to powerful individuals, unless you go to the universities and get money from these people. You get money from these people, you could then campaign and build your political career, but then, of course, they control you because they have paid you. That's the case with all so-called democratic campaigns, and that is and will continue to be the Achilles heel of democracy. Democracy is a fraud because what it truly is in actual practice is the privatization and the corporatization of the state. You know, libertarians, I'm sick of libertarians who claim that the economy, corporate America or corporate whatever, and the state are enemies. They're not enemies. They're one and the same thing seen from two different points of view. The state isn't independent. The state is financed by corporations and wealthy individuals. And even if that weren't the case, as of 2011, most of the important functions of the state have now been privatized anyway, or at least are really kind of this public-private partnership. Basil II understood this problem because so many of his forebears came to power because elite families had demanded that they come to power and support them and support their agenda. One of these big families was the Phokas family, one of the most significant and wealthy military families of the Byzantine Empire. And giving them their due, they did lose a lot of family members in the constant wars that the empire was involved in. But as the Phokas family, which was almost, you know, a state within a state, was threatening the very suburbs and walls of Constantinople, it was really right at that point where Vladimir's Vikings and Slavic horsemen came down and defeated this very important family and the loyalty that this family had with many of the rank-and-file infantry. from that point on, warriors from Rus' and Points North became a very important segment of the Byzantine army. So this isn't like Russian czars in later periods of time simply took the Roman mantle to themselves. They had long since married into the Roman Empire, in this case, the Roman Empire of the East. And even more than that, were an integral part of the administration, army, and economy of the Roman Empire of the East. So when Constantinople falls in 1453, after over a thousand years of existence, the Russian royal family, really it's only been two of them, the Roykids and the Romanovs, were long since a part of the Byzantine world. It was almost natural that Moscow then be the third Rome, because they had been an integral part of the empire. So it's not merely this claim to Roman status. It's not merely that they had married many times into the Roman imperial families, but also, even more, that they were an integral part of the day-to-day functioning of the Roman Empire in the East. Therefore, it's not outrageous for any of us to claim that in 1918, when the Bolsheviks murdered Tsar Nicholas and his family and the servants and the dog, that was the final fall of the Roman Empire. I should note, and I hate saying this, but these Jews, and it was exclusively Jews who murdered the Russian royal family, this was a true ritual. They recognized the fact that this is the end of the Christian Roman Empire, and of course they ritually violated the corpses of the girls, you know, Xenia and Anastasia and everybody else. So the point is that the enemies of the Roman Empire knew precisely what they were doing, that if the empire is to fall, then everything is to fall. The killing of the king ritual had its ultimate expression in murdering the last of the Roman Empire, and that was Tsar Nicholas II. But Basil II is a true forebear of what later develops in Russia and even in Byzantium. Basil II recognized that in breaking the power of the Eastern military families, he was able to unify and reform the empire, defeat the opponents of the empire, especially in the Balkans, and essentially build a relatively new Eastern and Southeastern European civilization. After the victories of Basil, both externally and internally, Basil II was able to confiscate the lands and the income of many of the most important oligarchical families. He used that money to distribute land to the soldiers and going back to the old Time system of rebuilding the system of independent soldier proprietors to lower taxes drastically and to unify and reform the bureaucracy, the administration, and its day-to-day functioning. And one of the most significant elements of Basil's reign is that he forced the wealthy to pay the taxes of those who were poor. And this proves that at its best, monarchy is a truly populist institution. It's extremely rare that you have any true alliance between the upper classes and the royal house. That's because the elite families want power themselves. The only real threat that a monarchy ever truly has is the threat that comes from the wealthy and the powerful. And traditionally, not just in Europe, but around the world, it's the poor and what we would call the lower middle class that looks to the monarchy for support against the oligarchy. But not only the personal virtue and strength of Basil II, but also the fact that the church and the courts and the administration in Constantinople had been reformed, had been strengthened, were staffed, by a very literate and intelligent civil service. This, finally, is what defeated the oligarchy. And this is one of the things that permitted the empire to last as long as it did. We all know the problems with bureaucracy. We all know the mentality of the bureaucrat. We understand that. We understand how perverted it could be. And yet, when you're dealing with an environment the Byzantines had to live within, you realize that this centralized bureaucratic structure was absolutely necessary to make the best use out of the income and resources of an empire that was always under siege. Anyway, I think I've made my general point as to why the empire lasted as long as it did, how and on what grounds. We've dealt with Byzantine figures on this show in terms of religion and philosophy, but today we have dealt with really the more material side of the Byzantine Empire. And a good friend of mine and supporter of this show had asked me to deal with this topic, and I'm responding to him. I get a lot of requests, and I can't answer every one of them, but this is something that's really worth talking about. So I thank you guys for listening. As always, I thank Mike Connor for taking care of the technical side of the show, and he's doing everything by himself now. So if you guys could send him anything financially, he's working around the clock to try to keep this on the air, and he's working by himself. So anyway, Mike, thank you very much, and my listeners, both those who support me and those who oppose me, I appreciate your time, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.